MacCast, Monday, August 22nd, 2016. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to be back here with you for another week of Apple and Mac news. We've got some good things to talk about. Of course, we're going to get into the latest on iPhone 7 rumors. It's not going to be a week that can go by until the actual announcement, where I don't think we're going to have something to talk about in that arena. Some interesting things happening with Intel and some chip licensing. We're going to get into that. Tim Cook did an interview over at the Washington Post, and I have some thoughts and comments on some of the things that were said in that interview, kind of linking back to some things I said early on when Tim Cook took over at Apple. Rumors of a potential new iPad. We're going to talk a little bit about Intel processors. Intel actually had some events going on this week, so there's a lot of Intel in the news this week. But something related to the processors and the potential new MacBook Pro. Also, Apple inked a new deal for Apple Music, and there's some new features to talk about. And some Apple Store updates, some little changes going on over at the Apple Store. We have all of that, including some follow-up from last week's episode of the MacCast, some additional questions about doing backups and archiving, and we're going to talk a little bit about what happens when you're in the non-Mac world and you need to do backups. We'll get into that in a little bit. Questions on storage media, and also I have a great thing of the moment for you this week. But before we get into all of that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. This week, I want to talk to you a little bit about PDF Pen from Smile, and not just PDF Pen Pro or PDF Pen Scan Plus, but the entire family, the Mac apps, the iOS apps. It really gives you the ability to manage and edit and work on PDFs from anywhere and everywhere you need to, when you have kind of the whole suite of PDF Pen products. PDF Pen for Mac, for example, is your ultimate editing tool for working on PDFs, and you can get that exact same power in the mobile applications for iPhone and iPad. PDF Pen for iPhone, PDF Pen for iPad, and that is one universal application. So when you buy one, you actually get support for both, and they recently added support for Apple Pencil. So if you're an iPad Pro user, like myself, you can do annotations, take notes right on top of your PDFs, which is really cool. PDF Pen Scan Plus is their app that adds scanning and OCR to your mobile workflow, so you can actually take out your iPhone and with PDF Pen Scan Plus quickly and easily scan in any documents right into PDFs. And not only that, it OCRs that data, so you get the underlying text data so you can search them. Great for scanning receipts and things if you're tracking business expenses. And having all these things together and integrated really helps you break that whole cycle of paper, you know, having to do things like scan, print, sign, and then fax. Do people even fax anymore? I think they do. Some people do, but you can totally go paperless. You can save money on your office supplies. And once your PDFs are PDF penified, yeah, that's a term that I just made up right now. PDF penified, once you have them in there, you can work with them so easily. You can add text, you can add graphics, you can make corrections and do a whole lot more. And PDF Pen 8 just added support for audio notes and file attachments. So they're constantly updating these apps, adding great new features. And when you have all of your PDFs with you in PDF Pen, you can have them whenever and wherever you need them. PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad can save PDFs to the cloud, to iCloud, to other document providers like Microsoft OneNote, and you can integrate all that stuff. So it really simplifies your workflow. And PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro 8 are running very well already on macOS Sierra, the beta, so they're ready to go. You'll be ready to upgrade to the new operating system with PDF Pen from day one. And you can check out all of the details by visiting smilesoftware.com/maccast. You can see the whole PDF Pen family, along with all the other great applications made by Smile. We love having Smile as a sponsor, and a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. Well, right at the top of the show here, let's rip the Band-Aid off, because as I mentioned, as we get closer to the launch of the iPhone 7, more and more rumors. I start to get a little bit tired of covering the rumors and hearing about them. You probably get a little tired about hearing about them, but I think they're important. You know, there's always new stuff coming up, new little insights, and we like to speculate on this stuff. Let's be honest. In some ways, it's kind of fun to think about what's the iPhone 7 going to look like? What are we going to see when Apple actually announces it? Some people kind of think it ruins the surprise, but I don't, because I, you know, until Apple actually says what the actual features are and we actually see it, you know, all of these have to be kind of taken with a grain of salt. So supposedly this week, an iPhone 7 assembly schematic was leaked to nowhereelse.de. And they've in the past had some leaks show up that turned out to be accurate. So we'll give them the benefit of a doubt. And in this one, it shows a lot of the rumors that we already heard about. The fact that it's going to have kind of the same design and the same shape, same size. You've got the single antenna line that's going to go around the top and bottom, so no longer going through the middle, which is actually a design change that I like. No 3.5 millimeter headphone jack. We've been talking about that for a long time. This particular schematic, because it's the iPhone 7, shows the larger lens, not the dual camera lens. And it also does seem to mention the new haptic home button. So the fact that the Touch ID sensor and the home button are going to be kind of integrated right in. It's not going to be an actual physical button. It's going to be more like your Magic Trackpad or the trackpad on the newer MacBooks and MacBook Pros, where it's actually using haptic feedback, or I would imagine Apple's going to use their Taptic Engine. That's kind of their marketing term behind that. So it'll feel like you're pressing a button, but there's actually no physical press. You're actually just pressing on glass. I think they'll still kind of have a little indent. I don't think it's going to be totally flush. At the very least, there is going to be the Touch ID sensor ring there. I don't think that's going away. So it's going to be interesting to see how that mechanism works. But it does show that. But the interesting thing that came out of the schematic was it does mention that, or it does show rather, that it has the symmetrical speaker holes on both sides. And in earlier leaks, a lot of people were speculating that because they're getting rid of the headphone jack, you no longer have that on the left-hand side, that we may be getting finally stereo speakers or stereo sound in an iPhone. Well, this schematic, if you want to believe it, kind of quashes that rumor, because it seems to indicate that on that left-hand side, yes, there's symmetrical holes, but they're purely cosmetic. There's just little mesh in one of those holes for a microphone. The rest are cosmetic. They don't actually go all the way through. And I wouldn't put this past Apple. This seems to make sense. You know, I don't really know how much an iPhone would benefit from stereo speakers. I know other smartphones do have stereo sound. I tend to not like to listen to the sound coming just out of the speakers, but I guess if they could put a better sound system in there, it's kind of tricky and something that small. So this isn't really bumming me out all that much, but it did come through this week, and some people are disappointed that we might not be getting stereo in the iPhone 7. Nowhere Else also mentioned that the camera lens, and this is actually a good bit of news for those of us who are worried about, you know, not buying the dual lens sensor iPhone 7 Plus and getting that extra camera functionality. It's sounding like on the iPhone 7, we are going to at least get one new feature, and that is optical image stabilization. Nowhere Else is reporting that that is going to be coming to the new iPhone 7, the non-Plus version of the camera. In prior generations, the iPhone 6S Plus, and I want to say the 6 Plus was the one that added optical image stabilization to the camera, but it up until this generation was only on the Plus models. It's sounding like that feature is actually going to make its way down. So that's a little bit of good news on the camera system there. There's also a rumor out, although this one seems to be a little bit iffy, that the new iPhone might support rapid charging, 5 volts at 2 amps. Right now, I think the iPhone charges at 5 volts with 5 volts at 1 amp. So the idea here would be you could rapidly charge up to a 50%, 75% charge, then it would kind of slow down. It came from kind of a sketchy Twitter source, so who knows if this is going to happen. Again, this is another feature that is in some higher-end smartphones out there, so Apple could add this feature just to compete. Be nice to have the ability to actually charge up, you know, get a very quick charge up on your iPhone when you're low and out and about. So I'd like to see this happen. This isn't related to wireless charging. When I first saw this report being reported, I thought, oh, maybe they're talking about this is the rapid wireless charging, because we have had the rumors that the iPhone 7 may have a wireless charging option, but that's not what's going on here. This would be a rapid charging through the Lightning connector. So again, just running at more amps. Another thing that's been rumored about and seems to be confirmed, I think this came out of some leaks of what is expected to be the logic board for the new iPhone. We've had these rumors that Apple would be moving away from Qualcomm chipsets for its LTE modems and switching over to Intel. That does seem to be confirmed by this latest leak. Again, we have to take all the leaks with a grain of salt, because we're expecting that these are, you know, we're assuming these are actual parts, but we don't have actual verification. But it does seem to show an Intel LTE modem chipset in there, although it also shows a Qualcomm RF transceiver. So Apple may be using the Intel modem, but still sticking with Qualcomm for the RF technology. So that's very interesting. This next rumor, I prepare to be shocked. I know this is going to blow your mind, but Maka Takahara claims that they've confirmed that there is not going to be an iPhone 7 Pro. Yeah, shocker, right? Well, we think we all knew this was not a real rumor. Early on in the cycle, there was this rumor that Apple was going to do three models of the iPhone 7, the iPhone 7, the iPhone 7 Plus, and then the iPhone 7 Pro. There had been rumors that there might be an iPhone 7 that had 7 Plus that had the dual lens system, and then one that didn't, and the dual lens one would be the Pro. I never put much stock behind this. I think this may have been an early thought process. Maybe there were some R&D prototypes out there, but it just doesn't seem like this would be the time for Apple to add another phone into the iPhone lineup, especially with, you know, sales kind of slowing down. I think it just muddies up the product mix, and I really didn't expect it to happen. But that, quote unquote, is confirmed this week by Maka Takahara. We're also starting to get more strong rumors that the storage sizes will be changed up a little bit. We're finally dumping that 16 gigabyte model on the bottom end. I think we've talked about that last couple episodes. We're also hearing that 256 gigabytes is going to be on the top end. What's not clear at this point is are those changes going to be across the board? So are we going to see both the iPhone 7 and the iPhone 7 Pro coming in at 32 gigabytes, 128 gigabytes, and 256. There's been some speculation that the 256 gigabyte option might be exclusive to the iPhone 7 Plus, but I'm starting to feel like Apple's probably not going to do that. I think they're going to break down the sizes at 32, 128, and 256. Again, we're going to have to find out when Apple actually makes their announcements. Now, this one isn't directly related to any kind of iPhone 7 leak, but you know, we've talked back and forth about the removal of the 3.5 millimeter jack and all the ways that Apple might handle that. There's been rumors about Lightning earbuds and adapters. I personally think that if Apple does it, they're going to include a pair of Lightning earbuds or earpods in the box, because I don't think they want to admit that you need an adapter. I think an adapter will be available for purchase separately for those people who have higher end headphones that are already using a 3.5 millimeter jack. But I think in the box, Apple's really going to push Lightning as the new connector. And then, of course, you've got Bluetooth options as well. And they may put out soon new models of Beats or other things that would include Lightning connectors and Bluetooth connectivity. But Intel has been out touting, again, I mentioned they had that event this week, they've been touting USB Type-C digital audio specification as the next generation for doing digital audio on mobile devices. And I find this interesting. I don't think Apple's going to ditch the Lightning connector anytime soon, But just the thought of maybe Apple standardizing on the USB-C connector across the board is very intriguing to me. I really believe that when they come out with new model MacBooks and MacBook Pros, that they are going to standardize on that single connector, the USB-C, because it can do Thunderbolt 3, it can do audio, it can do power, all of these things. So you have the kind of the one port to rule them all. And the idea of moving to a single standardized connector across the entire product line, I think is kind of a cool concept. And I wouldn't mind if Apple actually moved in this direction. Again, I don't think we're going to see it with the iPhone 7, but maybe the iPhone 8 will switch over to USB-C as its main connector on the device. And then finally, when are we actually going to get the official announcement of all this stuff? There's been a lot of speculation back and forth on that, including something this week that happened with Barbra Streisand that has some people thinking we might have to wait all the way till the end of the month, September 30th, for the release. She had complained, apparently, to Tim Cook that Siri was not able to pronounce her name correctly, even after she, you know, using the technique where you would go in and tell Siri, no, that's not how you pronounce it, because the alternate pronunciations weren't correct in terms of the suggestions. So Tim Cook wrote back, apparently, told her, yes, we will fix that, and the fix will be out on September 30th. So that seems to indicate that we would get iOS 10 on September 30th, and we typically have an iOS update right around the launch of a new phone. But that doesn't jive up with some of the other rumors we've been hearing. There have been leaked documents this week from AT&T that seem to indicate that there will be pre-orders on September 9th and a launch date of September 23rd. And why those dates? Well, it's because it lists those two dates as dates for doing merchandising resets in the store. And that would line up kind of with the time frame, a typical time frame for Apple to release stuff. So the assumption is that iPhone pre-orders will happen on the 9th, release date followed on the 23rd. So why this discrepancy with the potential release of iOS 10 and the whole Barbra Streisand thing? Well, I think the most logical explanation for that is that Apple probably has a version of iOS all ready to kind of go and set up. It's still in final testing. I know with betas, they put out iOS 10 beta 7, I think, last week. So it's still in testing. They haven't gold mastered it, but it's probably feature locked. So my guess is that Tim Cook is going to roll the Barbra Streisand update into the first update release of iOS 10. So we could see iOS 10 10.1 or maybe 10.01 pretty early, right after the release of the iPhone, almost within a week, if that date turns out to be accurate. So that's probably what's going on there. But I'm putting my money on, we're going to have an Apple announcement on September 7th with a pre-order date on September 9th, and then shipments going out on September 23rd, rather. So I'm going to put that date in the sand, and you can call me on it if I don't get that right. Now, one thing that we can almost pretty much confirm is that the iPhone 7's A10 processor is likely going to be produced by one or two companies. The rumors have been that TSMC is producing iPhone 7 chips exclusively for Apple, but Apple also uses Samsung from time to time. And that's kind of been the state of iPhone processors for a while now. Well, I mentioned earlier that Intel was having their developer forum, and at that forum, they announced something very interesting. They announced that they plan to allow third-party semiconductor companies to use their 10-nanometer production lines to manufacture ARM-based chips for smartphones. Now, this means that Apple could potentially use Intel as another supplier for A-series chip fabrication in the future, or it seems that way. Now, how quickly that might happen depends on a couple different things, and the story gets very interesting the more you kind of dive into it. But essentially, I think what's going on here is Intel, in a lot of ways, missed the boat in getting in on smartphone chip manufacturing. And they kind of stayed focused on PC sales and PC processors and things like that. But as you know, PC sales have been slowly declining, and they may be looking for a way to jump back into chip production for smartphones. And since their own mobile processors, they've done, I think, okay in convertibles and tablets and things like that. But on smartphones, they really just haven't had anything stick. So this would be a great way for them to kind of move back into that. Now, there's nothing official here, of course, but rumors for years and years have been that Apple's been talking with Intel about potentially manufacturing chips for the iPhone and iPad. So taking Apple's A-series custom designs and Intel actually doing the manufacturing. Now, a sticking point on this new deal, though, is that the ARM license that Intel has apparently is quite limited and might not be able to account for Apple's heavily modified designs. The license seems to include a couple of future ARM-based designs, and it's limited to specific designs coming out of ARM. Now, Apple has its own in-house team that takes the ARM core technology and kind of tweaks a number of things in their chip designs. So whether or not with the current license, Intel would be able to actually bring Apple on board and let them use their 10 nanometer production lines seems unclear at this point. I'm going to continue to look into it and research it. But for now, I don't think that TSMC needs to worry because I think Apple likes having multiple suppliers for their chips. Very often, they'll get into production cycles where, as you know, we've heard about delays due to manufacturing problems and stuff like that. So they always like to have multiple suppliers in place. In the past, it's been TSMC and Samsung. Apple's been wanting to move away from Samsung for a long time. So if I were Samsung, I would not count on getting very many, if at all, of Apple's chip business anytime in the near future, especially with Intel kind of entering the fray like this. So I think this is good news for Apple. This is good news for Intel. Probably bad news for Samsung. And Apple already has an agreement in place right now with TSMC to produce the 10 nanometer A11 chips for any devices coming out in 2017. So whether or not Intel would be brought on board in 2017 seems kind of not likely. It might be 2018 before we hear of any kind of deal between Apple and Intel. And that may work out fine, just fine for Intel, because again, they may have to expand their ARM licensing agreement a little bit to actually be able to really get Apple's business. So we're going to stay tuned and kind of watch this one, but I thought that was a very interesting development that came up this week. Now, I want you to remember back quite a ways, back to, 2012, when Tim Cook was transitioning into being CEO at Apple. I actually did a number of episodes back then where I talked about a lot of the sort of, I don't want to say complaints, but there was a lot of criticism being levied against Tim Cook, and people were still very much trying to put him and view him in the shadow of Steve Jobs. And I just kind of felt that that really wasn't a fair or accurate thing to do. And I talked about, I think at the time I called it, we need to let Tim Cook be Tim Cook and be the CEO that he wants to be. And as a matter of fact, we even found out later through the Steve Jobs biography and through some of the things that Tim said, that that was directly what Steve told him to do. Say, he told him, you know, you need to be your own CEO, you need to make your own sort of way and do the things that you want to do and keep the core of Apple the core of Apple, but within that, you know, take on this company and you know, continue to do great things with it. And there's a great Washington Post interview that came out this week with Tim Cook where they asked him a number of things. But what I took away from it was that he really is taking Steve's advice to heart. And I think he's putting together and, you know, continuing, I guess I shouldn't say putting together because Apple was already a great company, but he's continuing to expand the legacy of Apple and do a lot of really great things. And I think changing Apple in a lot of ways that make this Apple Tim Cook's Apple. And I think that's really great. And a couple of things, I'll link to the article in the show notes at maccast.com because you really should read the whole thing. But just some of the takeaways that I got from it, I want to go through here a little bit. And, you know, one of the things that he focused on right up front in the interview is that the primary goals at Apple remain the same, that their mission is to make insanely great products that really change the world in some way and enrich people's lives. That's kind of the core value, and that's never going to change. They're going to always keep that. But then there's all the things that sort of Tim Cook has brought in and started to influence. So, of course, the interview starts to ask him a lot about the complaints recently that, hey, Apple's not innovating fast enough, they're not expanding fast enough, and Tim immediately points out, and I think rightly so, that Apple has done a great job at managing growth, keeping margins high, expanding into emerging markets like China and India, and also expanding the role of Apple products in different markets, especially things like iPads and enterprise and stuff like that. And he talks in the interview about the transparency that Apple has brought in that under his tenure, doing more things on social and environmental issues, not transparency with their products, right? That's still super secret. They don't talk about that. Although he does admit that product secrecy is getting a little bit more difficult to maintain, but he mentions not wanting to be a CEO who is disconnected from his customers. And, you know, it's interesting because Steve Jobs, I don't think, was ever disconnected from his customers, but it felt that way. Whereas I get the sense with Tim Cook that when customers interact and send emails or make comments or stuff like that, he's more sort of readily there. He's not like available. I don't think he's answering all of his emails and sending them back to people, but I think he does occasionally. And I think he cares a little bit more about those interactions. And I think that's really, really cool. Apple's always taken to heart customer feedback. They really, I think, do still care about their customers. They're not ultimately going to make product decisions just based on what customers want, but I think they do listen to their customers. And Tim points out in this interview that, hey, I want to be a CEO who's connected to my customers. And I think that makes Apple and Tim Cook just a little bit different than a lot of other companies out there. Another great thing that comes out in this interview is Tim Cook is more open about admitting mistakes. He doesn't try to hide those things. He kind of comes right out, comes forward and says, yeah, we made these mistakes. Points out a couple of them in these interviews, specifically John Browett hiring him for Apple Retail, which didn't work out very well. But, you know, they turn around and they get Angela Ahrens, who's doing a great job. And he specifically mentions the launch of Apple Maps. You know, that was kind of a rough time for Apple. But I think the thing that makes this Apple Tim Cook's Apple is, one, they can be open and admit those mistakes. But secondarily, they're pretty swift and pretty good at correcting those mistakes. Again, Apple Retail completely turned around very quickly when Angela Ahrens was hired on. And Apple Maps, they did all the things they needed to do, and it's a pretty great product right now. And it's because it's going to be a core of a lot of products and services, I think, that they want to bring out in the future, including, and probably not limited to, the Apple Car project. The other thing that Tim Cook does that I think is a little bit different than Steve Jobs' Apple is he relies more, I think, on teams both inside and outside the company for advice. And that outside part, I think Steve did a little bit, but again, was a little bit more private about it. So he talks about turning to outside experts and friends in areas where he might need to make a decision, but he doesn't have the expertise to do that. But more importantly, and I think this almost gets glossed over in the article, is he's smart enough to know when he may or may not use that advice. So hearing the opinions is important. I think this goes the same way for customer feedback. Hearing that stuff is good, and factoring that into the ultimate choices and decisions that are made is good, but you don't have to follow the advice of everyone, even if, you know, they may be an expert in a particular field, because when you're developing new products and services and you're trying to change the world, sometimes you have to break the rules a little bit. And that's just, you know, my perception. Those aren't his exact words or anything from this interview, but I found that very insightful and very positive. And I think that's a great way to be thinking. And so when he got more into sort of what's happening with investors and people like that, he points out that investors can often be short-sighted. And this is something I completely agree with. Very often they're looking at next quarter's numbers or this year's numbers or something like that. But if you go back and you look at the big changes that Apple has made, the big dents in the universe that they've done, Apple's achievements are often measured in longer periods, 5 years, 10 years. And those were the big, you know, impactful changes. And when those things happen, the revenues and sales numbers and all those things, those are the things that follow, right? And they grow and they cycle. And we're just seeing another cycle. And one of the numbers that was thrown out in this interview, you know, he was asked about what's changed at Apple since he's been CEO. And he points out that the company is 4 times larger by revenue since 2010. So he's 4x'd the revenue growth in just 6 years. And so he's got a much bigger company. This is a much bigger company, a much different company in so many ways than Steve Jobs had to manage during his tenure. So that's another huge difference between the two CEOs. You know, he's dealing with a lot more moving parts, a lot more logistics, and just, you know, all of that stuff. And so he's head on taking on the criticism that everybody's trying to level, that, you know, maybe Apple's better days are behind them. And he points out, I think, one of the best things to point out when you're Apple is that all of this stuff has been said before. Apple's been doomed so many times and it's never happened. And I guess some would argue, well, then it eventually has to happen, right? But I don't think so. You know, every year is not going to be an up year. Every year is not going to be the best year that Apple has ever had. And they've had a really good long run. And I think they're going to have a period where it's leveled off a little bit. I don't think we're seeing, again, huge declines. And he just doesn't seem worried about it. And I don't think he should be. And so I thought he was just, you know, he's always well composed and very thoughtful in his responses. And he just did a great job in this interview. So then he was kind of asked, well, how is Apple going to grow then? And of course, he points out services, which has been doing very well. It grew $4 billion in revenue in the last 12 months. And he expects that just the services business will be about the size of a Fortune 100 company next year, which is just, that's the other thing you have to remember about Apple, is almost every division, every product category inside Apple is like its own Fortune 100 company. And he points out revenue or enterprise growth for iPad, which I think is good, but I don't think this is really going to turn around iPad. Apple will continue to sell iPads kind of how they have been. It's going to be okay, but I don't think it's going to be great. Tim seems pretty positive on that, so I'm not so sure on that. He also points out markets, expanding into emerging markets, especially India, I think is a big one for Apple this year. But so far, as you know, it's been kind of challenging for them. So if they can crack it, I think that'll be a big deal. But if they don't, I'm not really sure what other markets they can really expand into. So this year is going to be kind of a year, I think, really to watch India. And I think Apple's going to be very, very focused on India as an emerging market. Of course, he didn't get into products. They won't talk specifics about products, but he did say this, and I think this is the absolute correct way to think about it, is look at what Apple's strengths are. And then, you know, their main strength with developing consumer products is integrating hardware, software, and services. Really what I would argue is the consumer experience, right? They create an entire consumer experience. He said, take that idea, take those concepts, and apply those concepts to markets that Apple is not in yet. And you probably have a pretty good idea of where the, you know, what the new hardware products are going to be. And look at their R&D. I mean, he talks about R&D. They've ramped it up significantly. And he says that's because we're investing in the future, you know, both in current product lines and improving those, but also in, you know, other things that you're not really seeing, stuff like services and obviously new products. And Cook announced just this week that Apple plans to build a new R&D center in China. So they're putting a lot of investment in R&D. And I think that's the right thing to do when you're kind of in between these product cycles. It's very smart. They're working on stuff. They're looking at ideas. They're exploring stuff. But the thing about it is they're not going to announce anything. They're not going to show their hand. They're not going to do anything till they have the whole thing beginning to end figured out and they know that they can make an impact. So while it looks like they're standing still from the outside, They're definitely not doing that. You know, other companies are out there sort of publicly throwing stuff against the wall, showing their hand, showing you what they're working on. But you'll notice they don't have cohesive, great products. They don't have something that's consumer friendly. They have little ideas and early adopt stuff that early adopters, tech geeks like us like, but, you know, nothing spectacular. And Cook does mention that, you know, AI, artificial intelligence, is going to make your smartphone even more essential to you. So we know they're working on stuff with Siri and artificial intelligence. That's going to continue and probably surface in many ways across their entire product line. So, you know, if I were to kind of speculate on future product markets that I think I see Apple getting into, you know, where are they going to be doing impact in making an impact? Artificial intelligence, I think, is going to be a huge area. And specifically, if you go back and listen to my interview with Brian Romilly, and I know I bring this up from time to time, but if you missed that episode, you really should listen to it. He talks about something called voice first screenless interfaces. You know, what does the future look like when you have a user interface and you don't have a screen? Apple's skill sets applied to that kind of product, bringing a cohesive consumer experience to that, could be absolutely amazing. You know, you're going to need to have artificial intelligence. Things are going to need to be much more predictive. The system's going to need to understand much more context and have a lot more information built into it to be able to, you know, work correctly. And we see other companies, again, playing around with this, but I don't think you see anybody with a completely finished product. When you can have an entire interface, do an entire task all with your voice without looking at a screen, I think that's the thing we're going to see Apple ship. Virtual reality, augmented reality, I think this is something that Apple's playing around with. But again, I don't think, if you look at products that are on the market now, no one's nailed a consumer experience, especially for virtual reality, outside of games. You know, what are the applications? What could Apple bring to market here that's going to be really impactful? And I tend to think that Apple's going to be more focused on augmented reality rather than virtual reality. But Gene Munster, you know, remember, this is the guy that thinks that Apple was going to kept reporting that Apple was going to make an HD TV. He thinks that Apple's going to open up the iPhone platform, rather, for third parties to make authorized VR headsets by 2018. I don't think that's what Apple's working on. You know, other rumors suggest that Apple has assembled a large team of virtual reality and augmented reality experts for working on a top secret virtual reality headset project. Again, I think this is an R&D project. I believe that Apple is doing work in this area. But really, what would the consumer application for that be? What would be the consumer experience that Apple would deliver around virtual reality? That's the thing we have to think about. And I can't come up with anything at the moment. I'm sure Apple's got a lot smarter people than I am working on it. So they'll come up with something great. And if there's a consumer product there, if they can make a dent in the universe with virtual reality, then that's when we'll see a product. And we'll all look back and go, oh, okay, that makes sense. And then the last consumer product I think that Apple is really focused on, and I strongly believe that this is the case, is that Apple is building a car service. I don't think the car project is going to wind up being a consumer car that they're going to sell. You're not going to walk into an Apple store and walk out with, you know, an iCar or an Apple car or whatever you want. I think they're looking at an electric car that is autonomous and operates as a on-demand car service. So rather than buying a car, you would spend a certain amount per month or every year, buy into Apple's car service and have cars on demand when you want them. And I think that's what their investment in China with Didi Chung is all about. I think we've heard about acquisition talks that came up this week that, you know, Apple has been, or at least Lyft has been trying to get into acquisition talks with Apple. I think it's more the latter than the former. But they have an interest in things like that. Their mapping efforts, I think Eddie Q said in an interview that was a big part of, I think it was Eddie Q, I think it was a big part of a the platform. It was a platform that they needed to build future stuff off of. And I think mapping and all that data is going to be of critical importance to autonomous vehicles. And now we've got Uber moving into the self-driving car service space with some active trials that they announced they're going to be starting this month, I think, in Philadelphia. So you're going to be able to, in some instances, call up an Uber in Philadelphia, and it's going to turn out to be a fully autonomous self-driving car. There's still going to be a couple guys in the front, researchers, so they're working on it. It is a trial. But the idea is that we're moving there. We're moving there pretty quickly. And I also pointed out that, you know, in America, this is a concept that's going to be a hard sell from a marketing standpoint, but there's a lot of other global markets that Apple could start a car service in. China would be ideal for this, where they're not as dependent on, you know, owning their own cars or having their own vehicles as we are here in the U.S. And I think younger generations are getting used to the idea of carpool services and services like Lyft and Uber. And I think, you know, dynamics are changing. So Apple's always building products for a future, not, you know, the past. They skate to where the puck is, I think is the term that Steve Jobs would often quote, which is, I think, a Wayne Gretzky quote. So, you know, skating to where the puck is what Apple's going to do. So I think, you know, you look at all this stuff and that's what's going on. This is Tim Cook's Apple. He's changed it in a lot of really great ways. I think it's still a really great company. I don't think any of us Apple fans need to be worried about the future of the company. I think they're going to make amazing products, come out with amazing services, and do really, really well. And I hope Tim Cook is around and is, you know, CEO for a long time to come, because I think he's doing a great job. But that's kind of my two cents on this. So if you get a chance, read the piece, and I'd love to hear any of your comments or feedback. Maccast@gmail.com. Apple analyst Ming-Chi Kuo is claiming that Apple is planning on doing a new size of the iPad Pro, 10.5 inches, and may also be introducing a newer low-cost 9.7 inch iPad sometime in 2017. He also says that next year's iPads will be followed possibly by revolutionary changes to the iPad's design in 2018. Through the use of a flexible AMOLED display. Do you say AMOLED or AMOLED? I really don't know. I think it's AMOLED. Now I've got myself confused. Okay, we're just going to move on. AMOLED display. He doesn't think that even a new size or a lower price in 2017, though, will help stem the decline in iPad sales. He's still predicting a year-over-year sales decline between 10 to 20% for the iPad in 2017. As to why Apple would put out a 10.5-inch model, he says that it would have some more commercial appeal and more appeal in the education markets. 9to5 Mac is actually postulating the theory that Apple could maintain the physical size of the 9.7-inch iPad, but squeeze in a 10.5-inch display because the diagonal increase is just 0.8 inches. But if you look at the iPad frame, the 9.7, that would be a really tight fit. So they're saying edge-to-edge display on that model, which could look pretty cool and is an interesting size. I had one listener actually email me because we talked about this a little bit on the iOS show. And he pointed out that the 10.5-inch iPad Pro could be a screen that's the same resolution as the 12.9-inch iPad Pro, but just in a smaller form factor. And that would actually kind of make sense. When I first heard this rumor, I thought, why would Apple do 10.5-inch iPad? But if they can keep the form factor almost the same in terms of the physical size of the device and get a resolution that is on par or at the same resolution as the 12.9-inch iPad, that kind of simplifies things for development and might make some sense. So I'm starting to buy a little bit more into this rumor. Whether or not they would keep a 9.7 lower-cost iPad, who knows? And Ming-Chi Kuo didn't even talk about whether or not that lower-priced iPad, you know, what the price point would be. So, you know, currently I think it's about $399. So presumably lower than that at the entry-level model. He does think that Apple will use an older A9X processor in that lower-priced 9.7-inch iPad to keep costs down. And, you know, Apple has seen recent increases in the iPad Pro's demand in business and government markets, so it might make sense that they would build an iPad that would appeal more to those segments. As far as that radical change to the form factor in 2018, he does predict that that may be the thing that turns around the iPad sales a little bit. He makes no mentions of any updates for the iPad Mini or the iPad Air designs. I frankly think both those models could be destined to be discontinued. The iPad Mini a little less. I think they may stick that around, stick with the iPad Mini for another generation or two, but it wouldn't surprise me if this next round of iPad updates, they get rid of the iPad Air. You've got the 5.5-inch iPhone, and you've got this potential low-budget 9.7-inch iPad. So, you know, is there still room left for an iPad Mini? I think so. I think that's a form factor that a lot of people really like. The question's going to be, is that low-budget iPad, the 9.7, going to compete with the lower cost of the iPad Mini? And that could cause a little bit of consumer confusion. But sounds like there's going to be a little bit of shakeup in the iPad line probably early next year, maybe in the spring, I would guess, would be a good time for the iPad announcements, and even bigger changes coming in 2018, at least if we want to believe Ming-Chi Kuo. Intel recently showed off their 7th generation Core Kaby Lake processors at that Intel developer forum we talked about a little bit earlier. These new processors are following the Broadwell and Skylake designs, all using Intel's 14 nanometer process. The new designs support things like Thunderbolt 3, native USB 3.1, and DisplayPort 1.2. Plus, the built-in GPU in these new processors is said to keep up with 4K video and even high-end modern games like Overwatch. So pretty impressive technology in there. Plus, Intel says Kaby Lake processors are already shipping to manufacturing partners. So sounds perfect for a new MacBook Pro, right? Not so fast. Yeah, unfortunately. Intel usually rolls out their new processors starting with their low power models, the 4.5 watt Y series and the 15 watt U series chips. So think tablets and convertibles, maybe netbooks, those sorts of things. And then the other processors come out later. So the chips that Apple would typically use for, say, things like an iMac or a new MacBook Pro, those probably won't ship until near the end of the year at the earliest, and maybe even later. Now, in the past, Apple has received early chips from Intel before other manufacturers. That would be a coup if they could pull that off with an updated MacBook Pro, but it likely means that any rumored MacBook Pro update, which I expect to see this fall, probably in October, they're probably going to come with the quote-unquote older Skylake chips. And so the question then becomes, does it matter? Does it matter if we have Skylake and not Kaby Lake? Should Apple delay the MacBook Pro even longer just to get the latest generation of processor? There might be some advantages to that, but I think consumers and Apple fans might be a little bit miffed by that. So I fully expect that we're going to see a Skylake update in the MacBook Pro, unless they pull off some major coup, like I said, and get the Kaby Lake versions suitable for a MacBook Pro earlier than expected. And I expect Apple's also going to maybe do some iMac updates as well. Got a little rumor on that here in a second. But before we get to that rumor, let's talk about whispers of a possible Mac Pro update this fall. This rumor seems to be based on some rampant speculation that Apple might have a new version of Final Cut Pro ready to go in October around the time of the Final Cut Pro 10 Creative Summit. They're combining this with some hints that were found apparently in Mac OS 10 El Capitan, not Sierra, according to this rumor, but some hints in El Capitan that pointed at a new Mac Pro, and that's got a bunch of people salivating, and I can fully understand why. The Mac Pro hasn't been updated since 2013. 3 years, people. It is so long overdue for an update. Either that or Apple's going to kill it off. I don't know which is going to happen. I think a lot of people would be pretty pissed if Apple killed it off, but it could happen. We're either going to see an update or it is done. Because there's also some sketchy rumors of an iMac Pro update coming in October. And an iMac Pro could be the machine that kind of replaces the Mac Pro. A lot of, there's a lot of power wrapped up in those iMac designs, and that could be the replacement. What you lose, though, is some of the expandability, the really higher-end graphics cards and graphics processors. But if Apple could combine some things, that could work out. The sketchy rumor about an iMac Pro says that Apple would use an Intel Kaby Lake processor or an AMD Zen processor. I find either of these things not likely, again, because the Kaby Lake processors, one, aren't ready, and AMD Zen processor, I just don't think, that just doesn't seem likely that Apple would switch from Intel to an AMD Zen processor for the core processor in iMac. But that's what this is saying. They are also saying that Apple would use an AMD Polaris graphics chipset. I think that is much more likely, and that could be very impressive. But they're saying the Mac updates should be happening soon. When and where and what exactly we're going to see, I don't know. I really don't have a clue at this point. If I were to be a betting man, and maybe occasionally I might be in this case, I will throw out my bets that we will see a Mac announcement or some Mac announcements, including a new MacBook Pro, new iMacs, and maybe a couple other models sometime in the October timeframe. It would happen after Apple's September announcements for the iPhone. But stay tuned. We'll keep on top of the rumors surrounding this one. But what's your dream? You know, something I'd be curious about is, what is the new Mac that you're really waiting for and hoping for, and what specs do you want to see in it? Are you a Mac Pro person? Are you an iMac person? Are you a MacBook Pro person? We've had MacBook updates relatively recently, so maybe not so much there. But yeah, what is your dream Mac if you were in the market to buy one in the next 3 months? What would that look like? Shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. There's some interesting news this week surrounding Apple Music. There's a couple of new deals. Apple, via Instagram of all places, announced that it has a new deal with Cash Money Records and its co-founder, rapper Birdman. Yeah, I'm going to sound really not hip in this segment, just so you know, because I am so not when it comes to this music stuff. Details were not given, but the assumption of the agreement is there's some sort of exchange between Apple for whatever they're paying to get more artist exclusives and possibly co-produced content. I guess the big thing surrounding this deal is this is really the first exclusivity deal that Apple has done with a full record label. To date, they've been kind of doing deals one by one with individual artists. And Cash Money Records represents some pretty big names, including Drake, Young Money, Lil Wayne, and Nicki Minaj. So that is a pretty impressive lineup. Of those artists, they've put out 11 number one albums in the U.S. Cash Money Records has done 11 number one albums in the U.S. So this is kind of a really big deal. Drake, as an artist, of course, has already signed several deals and exclusives with Apple Music, including appearing at WWDC when Apple announced Apple Music. Apple also produced his music video for Energy with their in-house production team. So I would assume those kinds of things are going to be happening with these other artists as part of this deal. And some of the content already seems to be confirmed, because they actually released a trailer for a documentary about Cash Money. I'm assuming it's about Cash Money Records. I couldn't really tell from the trailer, but they're working on some video content for Apple Music. And Apple really sees these exclusives and the original content as a key driving factor in the growth of Apple Music. And so far, it really does seem to be working. In a little over a year, they've been able to get 15 million paying subscribers, and they have a very, very strong growth rate going. So the more of these deals that happen, I think it kind of becomes a snowball effect, and more artists get involved, see other artists jumping on board with Apple Music, and it all works out very well for Apple. And I think we're seeing some of their competitors scramble a little bit to try and compete. Apple has made a very big impact in a very short amount of time. And kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier, this is what happens. Apple is not always the first to market. They took a long time to get a streaming music service out. But once they did, it is a complete and cohesive package that really appeals to a broad base of consumers. And I think that's their big advantage. And they're doing it here with Apple Music. Another cool thing we're seeing happen with Apple Music is lyrics finally coming to the music app. They're in iOS beta 10, and they are awesome, by the way. But Apple posted this week a job listing for a lyrics curation manager to lead a team of what they're calling lyrics curators. So that kind of suggests that Apple is not simply relying on databases or bots or artificial intelligence for their lyric data. They're actually doing human curation. And that's another one of the big selling point features for Apple Music, is the accuracy and of, you know, recommendations and things like that, because they are actually having humans curate and not just using technology. I think it's a combination of both, but, you know, having humans in the mix is always a good thing. And I think especially when it comes to song lyrics, you're going to want that. So that's kind of cool to see them doing that. And I can't wait for that feature to hit the mainstream, because I think it's going to be very popular with a lot of people. And then, not directly related to Apple Music, but kind of entertainment related, and I thought this was interesting this week. I didn't realize that Twitter had secured the rights to stream the Thursday night NFL games. 11 NFL games will be streamed via Twitter. This was something that it was rumored Apple was in talks with the NFL to get this content. Well, they may get it by proxy, because there's a rumor this week that Twitter might be looking to put together an Apple TV app so that people can watch those sports streams. So Twitter may be the thing that brings sports to the Apple TV cord cutters, which is kind of bizarre and really cool all at the same time. Apparently, they've also reached agreements with an NBA, the MLB, the NHL, Pac-12 Network, and Wimbledon for sports content. And they're said to be working on deals with Major League Soccer and the Professional Golfers Association. So, wow, Twitter Sports. I don't know what, if they brand it as just simply a Twitter app or a Twitter Sports app. I'm sure it's going to be combined with the additional Twitter functionality. It's going to be interesting to see when that comes out, if it comes out. But I would love to see that. I think a lot of sports fans would love to see that too. So some kind of good news if you're into sports and are a cord cutter using an Apple TV. And then finally in the news for this week, a quick little story about Apple taking the store out of the Apple Store. And what do I mean by that? Well, it looks like Apple is dropping the store part from Apple Store names. And we don't know exactly why, but speculation is that they're doing it because if you look at a lot of other retail locations, especially high-end shops, they don't put store after their names. It's not, you know, Saks Store Fifth Avenue. It is just Saks Fifth Avenue. And Apple may be looking to do the same. So now it's just going to be Apple plus the location of the store. So Apple Fifth Avenue or Apple Union Square. And they made the changes to their website. That's where it kind of got noticed. It looked like the flagship stores were getting their names changed first, but it seems to be following through for all Apple retail locations. So my local store will just be Apple Carlsbad Forum here in San Diego. And you can apply that to your store as well. So I guess we don't call them Apple stores anymore. Apple also announced a few other announcements and changes to their retail store locations to retail staff. There's a couple new job titles that they put in place. There's now a pro, a creative pro, and a technical expert. Apparently, a pro is going to be a sales position above expert and is reserved for people who are most familiar with Apple products. Creative pros are going to have a similar level of knowledge to the pros, but be more applied to learning. And technical experts are going to sit between technical specialists and geniuses, basically taking on lower level support and repair tasks that would not require a genius. So they're trying to free up the geniuses a little bit more by adding in another job title. And there were a few other changes to what they're calling the different locations within the Apple Store for staff and things like that. But sounding like they're just going to see, these are all behind the scenes changes, rather, is what I wanted to say. These are behind the scenes changes, really not going to affect most of us as customers, except for the fact that maybe we'll get a little bit faster and a little bit better customer support when we're in an Apple Store. I was going to say Apple Store, an Apple retail location. I don't know what I'm going to say now that I can't say Apple Store, an Apple location. All right, with that is going to do it for the news for this week. I got a couple follow-ups from the last show. One thing is I got a confirmation on a feature of macOS Sierra. We were talking about the optimized storage options. So this is the thing that will let you kind of store items that are on your Mac's desktop in the documents folder and on the desktops folder in iCloud storage. And as you run out of space, it will like clear out older stuff that you're not actively using. And the question was, is that going to count against your iCloud storage? That has been confirmed now. So if you are using that feature, if you turn it on in macOS Sierra, be prepared to pay a little bit more for storage if you are using that feature, because you're probably going to use more than the built-in free 5 gigabytes that Apple gives you. I also talked about my backup strategy, and I talked about the fact that I use SuperDuper to create a clone of my internal Mac hard drive as one of my backup options. And I also mentioned that for archiving and some other applications, I use a product called Chronosync. Well, someone emailed me, and I actually knew this, but I haven't switched over because I'm a creature of habit. I've used SuperDuper for years for doing my clone backups. He pointed out Chronosync can actually create a bootable cloned backup. So you really, if you're going to buy Chronosync, if you're going to use Chronosync for some of the other things that I'm mentioning, you may only need Chronosync as your entire backup solution for both cloned backup and archived and, you know, other sorts of backup things that Chronosync can do. So I just wanted to mention that. We talked about a lost and stolen iPhone device. There was kind of a phishing scam that was going on for some people, and Bill wrote in and wanted to ask a couple questions specifically, and I get this one a lot. He said, is it more important to put the device into lost mode and keep it there so you can track it down, or should you more quickly hit the self-destruct button, you know, wipe the iPhone and not worry, so you don't have to worry about your data, so that, you know, you can, if you get it back, you can kind of reset it, you can restore it, but at least the thieves wouldn't have access to maybe some of the data that they could use to try and phish you and maybe unlock your device. And, you know, I think personally, it's really a personal decision, and it would depend on the scenario, right? It depends on, do you think you lost it, or did it actually get stolen? Where did it get stolen? Who do you think might have it? Where is it going? Is it going into a really bad part of town? Or, you know, did the guy at the coffee shop steal it and take it somewhere? So those things are somewhat of a factor. If you have Find My iPhone enabled and you're using a really secure, good passcode already, then I think placing it in lost mode is fine. The idea that anybody would be able to hack into your device and actually do anything with it, I think is slim at that point. And if you want to be able to track it and possibly have a way to recover it, you might want to leave that active. And Bill does point out the security concerns with that, right? If you're tracking your iPhone, what good is it knowing where it is if it's maybe not safe to go in and recover it? And, you know, I would say, yeah, absolutely. You never want to go into a situation where you feel it's not safe just to recover a phone. It's just not worth it. I would try to get help from the police. They may not always be available and willing to help, depending upon the specific situation. But I've known people who have called up and said, hey, my iPhone was stolen. I know where it is. I want to go recover it. Can I have an officer come down and just be there in case something goes wrong? I don't know if I'd personally feel safe doing that, but I know people have, And, you know, if you can get police backup, great, but a lot of places aren't going to give you that. And I think, Bill, you make a great point there. So if you can't work that out, I would say cut your losses and wipe it at that point. You know, just so it's gone. I'm not getting it back. I'm going to go ahead and wipe it. But, you know, as long as you think there might be a chance for recovery, why not give that a shot first? But that's just my personal opinion. Again, everybody's going to have to kind of make their own decisions with recovering their devices. And then another thing that I talked about, I think, in the last episode was two-factor authentication or two-step verification, turning that on as an additional layer of protection. And Daniel wrote me to point out that those two things, two-factor authentication and two-step verification, are not the same. And I didn't know this, and I think a lot of us didn't know this. It's not 100% clear exactly what the differences are, but Apple treats those things as two different things. So Apple claims that two-factor authentication is newer and more streamlined process than two-step verification. Two-step verification came first, and if you've enabled it on your device and you want to switch to two-factor authentication, that newer stuff, unfortunately, you have to completely disable two-step verification and turn on two-factor authentication. Daniel tried this and ran into a little bit of trouble actually even making that transition. He mentioned turning it off and not seeing the new options and having to kind of fiddle around with it a little bit. But the way you can check which version you're using is if you go into settings on your device, go into the iCloud settings, click on password and security, it will either say two-step verification or two-step authentication on. So you can check that out. But what a pain in the butt, especially if you have to completely disable two-step verification to switch. Because if you're like me, I use app-specific passwords. So those are all going to have to be completely redone. And I'm not looking forward to it. And I don't know what the big advantage of two-factor authentication is. It wasn't really clear from some of the support articles that I was reading. So if you happen to know and can maybe explain it in plain English and not Apple speak, let us know. Shoot us an audio comment. And the only other thing you need to be aware of if you are planning on switching is that some devices actually won't support the newer two-factor authentication. And I'm not sure that you can mix and match. I think you'll get a warning if you try and switch. If you have devices that aren't supported, it will tell you. So to use two-factor authentication, you have to have an iPhone, an iPad, or an iPod Touch running iOS 9. You need to have a Mac with OS 10 El Capitan and iTunes 12.3. Your Apple Watch needs to be running Watch OS 2. And if you use a Windows PC with iCloud for Windows, it needs to be version 5. And again, iTunes needs to be 12.3.3. So just be aware of that if you are planning on switching. But again, two-step verification, two-factor authentication, two separate things, and you may need to switch. And you may not even be realizing that you're using the older version. So thanks, Daniel, for sending that in. And thanks, everybody else, for sending your feedback on prior episodes of the MacCast. Now, one of the things we were talking about last week was backups and archiving and all that stuff. And Derek wrote in and brought up a really valid point about backups for people who don't use a Mac. What did they do for backup and archiving? And there's becoming a larger and larger portion of the population who are just iPad owners. My mom falls into this category, as well as my in-laws. And so what do they do for backup? Well, for sure, use iCloud backup. I mean, that makes sense. It's easy to turn on and enable, and that's pretty much your only option. But what about redundancy? What about archiving? What about those critical photo files that you have on your iPad? Are you going to trust iCloud backup as your only backup? And I don't know how I would feel about that, but I don't know what other options people really have. So I started to think about this question when Derek emailed it to me, and I guessed, there's a couple things you could do. You could work with apps that also include their own cloud-based storage. So they sync to iCloud.com or Dropbox or OneDrive or Box, and, you know, use that storage option to store your documents and things like that. That would serve as kind of a secondary backup. For photos, you could use an app like Flickr, which will actually sync all of your photos from your iOS device to the cloud, even stuff that you take with the camera. And so you could have a secondary photo backup in that way. And I think they give you a terabyte of free storage over on Flickr. So, you know, cloud backups are one. There are Wi-Fi connected storage options out there, and I think some Lightning connected storage options. So you could use that. They usually have an app that's included with it that you have to use to actually copy files out of the app and onto the storage device, but you could back up some of your documents and media that way, say to flash storage or other, you know, SSDs or removable SD cards, whatever it might be. So there's those products out there. And one thing that might help you there is there's a great app from Readle called Documents. That's basically a document manager. It's the closest thing I think you're gonna get to a Finder on iOS, and it will link up with various cloud storage services, online services, as well as let you connect to, you know, web dev servers and FTP servers and also a lot of these connected devices that you can buy that you can connect to your iOS devices. So you can kind of consolidate everything through Documents and then archive it off to these different extra storage options. You know, it kind of acts as the gateway for all of this stuff, and I think it's a really great app. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. So that's another thing that you could do. But I think ultimately, Apple probably really needs to start to address this issue, because you're going to have more and more people who have iOS devices, an iPhone, an iPad, but do not have a Mac or any kind of desktop computer that they could actually do additional backups to. Of course, if you have a Mac, you're going to want to periodically plug in your device, even if you're using iCloud backups, and back up to your Mac, and then use your other kinds of backups as additional places to store your iTunes backups of your iOS device. That's what I currently do. So I have all that stuff backed up, you know, say into CrashPlan and to other locations. But ultimately, I think Apple's going to need to create some sort of product like a time capsule, but for iOS devices, something that it can sync remotely and locally, so you're not relying just on Apple's iCloud backup. You can also have your own personal backup that's local to wherever you live, and just, you know, being just like backing up to iTunes, but without a Mac or iTunes. So they need to have a solution for that, and hopefully they'll come up with that at some point. But I thought it was a great question, Derek, and it really got me thinking. And if any of you have other creative ideas or thoughts on this topic, send us some feedback. Another thing that I covered was how to back up and archive your iMovie projects and events. And that brought up some other questions from many of you, including Justin, who was wondering about all of the old movie projects that he had that were already archived from older versions of iMovie. And he had questions like, will they work in newer versions? Should they be brought in and converted? And absolutely, Justin, I think they will work in newer versions. How far back, I don't really know at this point. So if you haven't been taking your archive projects and upgrading them, like if you had an iMovie 6 project in an archive somewhere, I don't know how you would open up those project files and actually play them back. You kind of need to migrate things along and bring them along with you. So if you do have archive projects, I would say grab those and try and pull them into iMovie 10 and see if you can get them upgraded. Even saying that, though, I will tell you, I haven't had a lot of luck with upgrading some of my older projects and things like that. Oftentimes, things will break. I know you can kind of hack in there and go into the package files and sometimes extract raw data and footage. But sometimes the project files themselves, even if they're archived, just break and they don't come in very well. They don't convert over very well. And I've actually lost some project stuff. Very rarely have I lost source material, but I have lost kind of project stuff. And the reason I don't lose the raw footage is part of my archival process is to always take the raw digitized videos or imported videos and move them outside of iMovie and put them into some sort of archive on my Drobo or into some other location so that I always have the raw source files in their native formats. And I, you know, create backups of those. And, you know, it's not ideal, but if you did have a problem with an older project file getting lost, you could recreate it from those raw source files. It's sort of a backup, not really great. But also in thinking about this, I thought, you know, the reality is that once I've completed a project in iMovie, I don't think I've ever gone back and wanted to re-edit one of those projects. So that's not saying other people don't do that, but I typically, you know, bring my videos in, I create my iMovie project, I create the movie that I want to make, I export that into iTunes. All my stuff in iTunes is backed up, and I have those final videos, those final edited videos, but those are the things that I come back and watch. And I've never gone back to a project to kind of re-edit a project after I've gone through that entire process. I don't know if that makes any sense. I've gone back again and grabbed raw source video and used the same video in other projects, but as far as, you know, going back and re-editing a project, I typically really don't do that. But Justin, your topic actually got me thinking that it's been a while since we talked about another topic that is a reoccurring topic on the show, which is what I call bit rot. You know, what happens and how do you plan for the situation where you have old document formats, old file formats, old media formats that you can no longer access? How do you make sure that you keep all of your digital data, your digital archives, retrievable? And it's certainly something that you need to think about. And there can be many reasons, you know, why the stuff doesn't become retrievable. Hardware changes, software changes, all of those sorts of things. And the sort of base strategy that I've started to employ for this is something I call minimum viable format, MVF, the minimum viable format strategy. And that is to always have a version of the content in some format that is going to be as open as I can think of at the time, or as universal as I can think of it at the time. So for example, if I have audio files, keeping a version of them in AIFF or WAV format or MP3 format. These are pretty standardized formats that have been around for a long time. Or if I have video files, making sure that they're you know, QuickTime movie files or M4V files, something in like an H.264 format that probably isn't going away anytime soon, but eventually might. If I have documents and text, storing that, a version of that in just a plain text file as an archive is a way to go. So it's not just in Word or dot, you know, a dot docx format or something like that. Don't expect proprietary formats or application formats to always be available forever. Hardware, I think, is even trickier. You know, what format are you going to store things on? If you have DVDs or CDs, now is the time to be thinking about maybe migrating that to some other format, to SSD storage or something that is more local. I think about all my old VHS tapes, or I have, you know, more recently these mini DV cassettes that I used to bring into iMovie, but I have all the raw footage on these micro cassettes, and I'm going to probably send those out to get converted and digitized and store those again in a Drobo or a Synology or something like that. But even think about something like floppy disks or zip drives. I'm sure there's people still out there with zip drives. And even if you have, you know, zip disks, even if you have a zip drive, how are you going to connect that to your computer? You know, media doesn't last forever, but players even last a shorter period of time, and connectors are even a shorter period of time after that. You know, are you going to take your SCSI zip drive? How are you going to plug that into your Mac? I don't even know if you could. You may be able to find an adapter, but it's going to get harder and harder to find those sorts of things. So this is something that we have to think about: media shifting, media format shifting, content shifting, minimum viable format strategies, those sorts of things, if we want to have longevity for our data. And it can kind of make your head swim. And at some point you kind of feel like, I don't care. You know, if it gets 30 years from now and I can't recover that stuff, too bad. But then you think about legacy, and you think about, you know, how many times have you found that old family photo and went, oh, this is great. And now that we have all these things in digital, wouldn't you want a future generation to still have that experience? Well, how are you going to make sure that that happens? Storing stuff online is potentially a way of handling that too. You know, loading everything into Flickr it's probably going to support JPEGs, and maybe, you know, if some other format comes along, maybe they're going to convert the stuff into the new format for you, because in order for their site to continue to work, they'd have to do that. So I don't know. I don't know what all the answers are, but it's certainly something that should be front of mind and we should be thinking about. Sebastian also had a number of questions related to storage and archiving of data, and I realized that I mentioned archives, but I didn't go into too many specifics about how I archive different kinds of data on my Mac. I talked about the ways that I did archiving, but I didn't talk about the specifics for certain kinds of data. And so Sebastian wanted to know specifically about iTunes photos and iMovie. And so I wanted to get into a couple of his questions. So he said, with iTunes, you know, how do I archive purchased video content that I do not want to store on my laptop? And for me, what I've done is I have all my iTunes media stored on an external drive. You know, that's relatively easy to do, and I'll cover that here in a second. But then I take that drive, and I have that drive synced over to my Drobo, and then I also have all of my iTunes media stored in my crash plan backups. So that's the way I kind of handle that. And I have my library on a powered USB drive, so I can either take that with me or not take that with me. And then more recently, the way I can still maintain access to all of my music when I have my laptop with me, but maybe I don't have my drive with me, is I have an Apple Music subscription and I use iCloud Music Library. So all my music is available for streaming or downloading on all of my devices or any Mac, even if I don't physically have my iTunes media library with me. And for purchased movies and TV from iTunes, again, those are re-downloadable. I think Sebastian specifically wanted to know, if I archive that off of my computer, off my Mac, you know, am I going to be able to watch those movies on Apple TV? And if they're purchased from iTunes, then absolutely, because you can access those through your account and you can stream those to your Apple TV. Now, if it's stuff that you've ripped yourself, that's going to have to be in your iTunes library. So again, moving that iTunes library maybe to an external drive or something with a little bit more storage to free up space on the internal drive on your Mac is a way to go. Now, the question that usually follows this is, well, if I have all of my media on my external drive, what if I'm going on a trip and I want to take some media with me and I want to be able to use that and access that, but I don't want to have to rely on streaming it or using something like iTunes Music, iCloud Music Library or something like that. And a lot of people don't know that if you set up iTunes media on an external and then disconnect it, what will happen if you launch iTunes is it will automatically default back to the internal default media location. So the iTunes media folder inside the iTunes folder inside the audio folder in your home folder. It'll default back to that. So one thing you can do is kind of have two iTunes libraries. You can have the external one and you can have the internal one. And I always keep the iTunes library file, the thing that's the metadata that points to where your media files are stored, I keep that locally on my Mac. I know some people move that, but I've had trouble with that in the past. So if you want to kind of set this up, I guess the first thing I should tell you is how you move your iTunes media to an external drive. So the first thing is make sure you back up your entire iTunes media folder. And then you can simply take that and move it to a new location or drive. So you just drag it over, copy it over to an external drive or to whatever location you want to move it to. And then you'll go into iTunes, into the preferences, go into advanced, and you'll want to check the options for keep iTunes media folder organized and copy files to iTunes media folder when adding to library. And then you just simply change the media location, the location of the media folder, set the new location to where you moved all your media files to. And then as a last step, go into the library menu under the file menu and choose organize library and then check consolidate files and click OK. And what that's going to do is that's going to run through, it's going to update your iTunes library files so that everything is pointed at the media folder on that external drive, and it's going to make sure that everything's consolidated and organized inside that media folder. So once you have that set up, now you're running your iTunes, your main iTunes library off that external. What can you do if you want to have not only the external library, but also an internal library, maybe with a subset of your content? Well, one thing that you could do is you could simply just, you know, copy those files over into a media folder, an iTunes media folder locally that has less content in it. And what will happen is that when you disconnect your external media folder, it will default back to the default location. And you'll see in your iTunes library all of your media, but a lot of it won't be found, right? It'll only find the stuff that's stored locally in the local iTunes media folder. So that's not really ideal. I really don't like that. What you can do is you can actually duplicate some of your content onto that internal drive, but then in addition, create a second library file to get around the problem of seeing all of your content. So you could create a second library file that just has the locally stored content. And the way you do that is when you launch iTunes, if you hold down the Option key, it will give you the option to create a second iTunes library file. So create a second iTunes library file, maybe call it iTunes Library Internal. And then once that's opened up, it's not going to have any media in it. Take any of your locally stored iTunes media, or just take the entire locally stored iTunes media folder, drag that onto your library, and it will populate it with just the stuff that's on your internal drive. So now when you're flipping back and forth, all you have to do is remember to switch which library file you're using. So when you're connected to your external drive, use that library file. When you're connected to your internal drive, switch over and use that library file. I know it's a little bit complicated, but once you kind of get your head around it, you can figure it out. And that's the way I would handle that. And then the last question I think Sebastian had related to iTunes was that if you have purchased movies and a new version of iTunes comes out, do those DRM videos need to be migrated in some way? So if you've archived your iTunes purchases, your iTunes purchased movies, do you have to bring them back in and convert them or migrate them when a new version of iTunes comes out? Generally, no. Again, Sebastian, you're going to be able to re-download that purchased content from iTunes. So I really don't think that's anything that you need to worry about. So then he also asked about, okay, well, what's the archive strategy? What's the best strategy for archiving photos in the photo library? And I don't know if I have a best strategy for you, Sebastian. Personally, I have all of my photos in one library that I store on my Mac. It's 71 gigabytes, and I just have enough storage locally where I can keep that entire library file stored. I do archive that stuff. But really the way I do it is I just back up the whole photo library file. I just take that whole file and archive it to different places. But one method that you might use is to export files and folders and archive them that way. And that would be good because this would fall under that strategy of, you know, minimum viable format. You just store JPEGs in some other location, in some folders. You know, you could export individual albums into individual folders and back things up that way or archive stuff up that way. Another thing I've seen people do is break up their photo library into smaller libraries. So just like with iTunes libraries, you can create multiple photo libraries by holding down the Option key when you launch the photo application. And so then you can take that and you can move or export your pictures or videos into those smaller libraries. And, you know, I think a common way to do that would be to maybe export each year of photos into its own photo library. So create a photo library for each year of photos that you have, and then you can back up those individual photo libraries. Of course, you still have the potential format shifting problem. So maybe you still want to export just the raw images and things like that. When I export, and then you asked, when I export pictures and videos as unmodified originals to a NAS, will the timestamp be preserved? And what about albums? I believe that the original date that the photo was created, its file created date, is maintained. but I'm not sure that other kind of date metadata is maintained. And I really don't know about albums. When you export a whole album, I think your best bet is to export it into a folder and just give that folder the same name as the album. And then you ask, what is the best way to move pictures from one library to another? Well, as I said earlier, you could just export those images that you want to move to a folder, create a new library, and then drag those photos into the new library. The issue with that is you're probably going to lose album and metadata, all of the structure that's built into that library, which is why I prefer to use an application. There's a great application from Fat Cat Software called Power Photos. It's $29.95 US, and it will allow you to split and merge and look for duplicates. It's a great tool for managing multiple iPhoto or photo libraries. And actually, the new license, I think, gives you versions for both iPhoto and the new Photos application. So I would use that for dividing up and splitting up iPhoto library or photo libraries, if that's the way you choose to go. And then you said, what happens when a new version of Photos comes out and I have to migrate the library? I guess I'll have to make sure I do that and not forget migrating. Yes, absolutely. Because again, this is that whole bit rot prevention that we were talking about. So if you have, you know, old libraries that are iPhoto libraries, remember iPhoto is going away. So if you've archived those iPhoto libraries, you're going to want to open those up in Photos, get them converted over to a Photos library so that you can continue to open them moving forward. I don't know how long Photos will continue to support old iPhoto libraries for migration. And as Apple brings out new versions, yeah, you probably want to open up those photo libraries and make sure that they get converted and that you can open them in newer versions of the application. I would certainly check that. And then you asked about iMovie, but I think I already more or less covered iMovie. But you did ask about the migration question, and we talked about that a little bit earlier. Yeah, you're going to want to migrate your archived iMovie project or movie project files as, you know, new versions come out and stuff like that. And then finally, in general, you asked, you know, what do you keep on your Mac and what do you have archived off? Is there any kind of strategy here? And again, it's going to be very personal. It's going to depend on the types of files and things that you have. But generally, I keep things on my Mac that I want immediate access to and archive the stuff off that I don't need immediate access to. I mean, it's really that simple. I think about, you know, am I going to access this? But it makes sense to me. So I can give you an example. For the MacCast, I keep the last four episode projects and I archive everything else. For client projects, when I'm working on web development stuff, I don't keep around old client projects. If I haven't worked for a client or I haven't done any work for a client for over a year, I'll take that, I'll move it out of my documents folder and archive it off into a place that I have set up in my Drobo. So I'll take that away. For my iTunes media and my photos, I keep all of that stuff because I want immediate access to it. But it really is kind of a personal thing. You're going to have to kind of think about your strategies. But I think a good rule of thumb is, am I using this? Do I need immediate access to it? Yeah, then keep it around. Don't archive it. But if it's something that you're only going to come back to once a year, once every couple years, certainly get that off of there. Archive it off, clean it off. And I know it's a hard thing to do. It's not always fun. It takes time. But your Mac will thank you for it because you'll have a lot more available storage around. So I hope that answers your question. And then moving on, I think the last thing that I have for you is my thing of the moment for this week. And it's kind of a cool one, something that I discovered that's pretty fun. It's a game called Reigns. And it's kind of a casual game where you take on the role of a succession of kings running a kingdom. And the way that you play is you're approached by various subjects in your kingdom and they're asking you to make decisions about various things. And the way you make your decision is you swipe left for one answer and you swipe right for the other. So some people are calling this the Tinder dynamic, game dynamic, but it's pretty cool. So you'll get a question and then you have to decide one way or the other. And it's not always a yes or a no. It'll be sort of different things. Oftentimes it's yes or no. And how you decide each question is going to have an impact on one or more aspects of your kingdom. There's four different aspects you're trying to keep in balance: the church, the people, the army, and the treasury, and to stay in power as long as possible, which is the goal of the game. You want your reign to be as long as possible. You've got to keep all four of these things in balance based on the questions. And we'll kind of give you hints as to, you know, what impact each decision is going to have. It gives you little dots next to the different aspects, and depending upon the size of the dot, it kind of determines, is this going to go good or bad for, say, the army or the people? And so you kind of make your decisions. And it sounds really simple, but it gets incredibly complex, because each decision that you make will also impact future requests and future decisions that you have to make. And also, as you progress through the game, you meet more and more subjects. You can get and earn additional cards that bring on new game scenarios that get added to the game, new questions, and it starts to get really intricate and really complex. There's also some mini game elements. So there's points in which you'll fight kind of battles, or you have duels. You'll navigate through a dungeon. You take on games of chance where you try and win money or lose money. So there's little gambling games that go on. And at the beginning of each reign, there's also a list of challenges that you try to meet to unlock more game features. So the whole thing is a lot of fun. It's really quick to play, so you can kind of do it in little sessions, or if you want to play longer, you can play as long as you want. And I think best of all is the fact that the game is just $2.99 US, and that's it. There's no in-app purchase. It's just the game, and it is a lot of fun. So it's called Reigns. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at mattkess.com. And that is my thing of the moment for this week. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media, and they are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome your feedback. You can send me emails or audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. Or you can leave me a voicemail on Skype, and my Skype username is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media, you'd like to follow me between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast, or you can check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real quick.